I wanted to maybe ask you if you could sort of give us, from your perspective, your take on Ezekiel 38 and why you believe that we are really on the cusp of seeing this prophecy about to be fulfilled with the recent geopolitical developments.
Well, first of all, I must address the issue of the chaos that we have nowadays in understanding Bible prophecy. And it has to be very clear that one of the things that Satan wants to do is to confuse the people of God. So much so that even at the time of Jesus, the disciples were confused as of Jesus' crucifixion and all of that, thinking that he's going to be there forever. And the point is that we have to always consider events in light of written Bible prophecy and not try to fix that which is written and change it according to what the events are. And I don't really, and for the last 15 years when I've been teaching about Ezekiel 38, I consistently said about, you know, Turkey and Russia and Iran as the main parts of the alliance in the north, and about Libya and Sudan as the main ones in the southern part of Israel. And I've said that way before Turkey turned their back to Israel, and way before Russia invaded into the Middle East, and way before Iran is now a welcome member in the international community. And so I'm not trying to reconcile the scriptures to the, events. Now, what we see is a tremendous set of events that setting the stage for Ezekiel's prophecy to come to pass. We see a Turkey that turns around from being friends of Israel to be one of the fierce opposition to Israel, and then becoming very, very, I would say, controversial in the eyes of the West, to the point that even this morning I read an article about the fact that Putin is running to the arms of, Erdogan is running to the open arms of Putin because the West is no longer accepting him. Erdogan is having, you know, issues now with NATO, with Austria lately, with obviously other countries, and you can see that Russia is waiting with an open arms for that. Iran, we all know, in light of the deal, that I wasn't in favor of it, but I could see it coming. Iran is now free to do what Iran wants to do, and Iran is definitely a key member in that alliance. Iran, Russia, and Turkey right now already collaborate and communicate, knowing that the rest of the world isn't really relevant here.
Did you hear about the breaking news just this morning that Israel is responding to Obama's claim that Israel is now seeing the merits of said Iranian nuclear deal? And so out of Israel today, perhaps you can elaborate on that. In fact,
Israel, the Ministry of Defense of Israel, as of yesterday, compared the Iran deal with the Munich agreement that was eventually something that brought, you know, to the front door, it brought World War II. See, Winston Churchill said once, I think it was in 1938, he wrote a letter to Lord Moyne, one of his best friends, and he said, and that was 1938, 5 years after Hitler got into power, and he said, regarding the German problem of the last 5 years, I have a sense that we're having a choice between shame and war, and my sense is that we're going to choose shame, and then war will be thrown at our doorpost in a much more adverse terms. And that's what we see. The world chose shame. The world chose to go and appease Iran, and Iran is blackmailing the West every single day right now, just so the West can still hold on to this agreement as the best deal ever. And we see that I can hear the sound of the drums of war rather than of the doves of peace all around us. So now, regarding Africa, we talked about it on the message a couple days ago. Israel is on the offense right now to gain support from the African continent, from the members of especially Western African continent. And we can see how it puts both Sudan and Libya on the offense right now. and you can see how they are very perplexed at what's going on, and they don't know what to do. And the Palestinians are now trying to convince Sudan that something has to be done. Needless to say that ISIS-controlled Libya is not a friend of Israel as well. And these two countries are singling themselves out from the rest of Africa.
Right.
You can see that. Egypt is our friend. Ethiopia is our friend. Eritrea is our friend. You can see Kenya is our friend. All those countries around them are either friends or becoming friends, whereas these two countries are standing and waiting for the opportunity to somehow get back on us.
Mm-hmm.
And the time is coming. These are Put and Kush. These are the two countries Ezekiel mentioned. Never before in the history of planet Earth, the geopolitical situation in the Middle East looked so real and so close to that which Ezekiel 2,800 years ago predicted.
Yeah. Do you see a shelf life of sorts, or an expiration date, if you prefer, when it comes to prophecies like Ezekiel 30? And by that I mean, all of the nations now, as we speak, are at the ready and in alignment. But in 5 years from now, so much could change in terms of those nations that today are
correct
at the ready.
I'm going to say this. I personally believe that Ezekiel 38 will eventually usher the rise of the Antichrist,
mm-hmm.
which means bringing peace to that war-inflicted Middle East. I cannot see, from what Daniel prophesied, I cannot see America being the one who brings peace to the world at that time. I cannot even see anyone in Asia doing that. Speaking and looking into Daniel's prophecy, I can only see a Western European leader coming and introducing peace. And the thing that I'm trying to say is that we're going to see how big countries of today becoming irrelevant,
mm-hmm.
and how irrelevant areas as Western Europe today becoming more and more
right.
relevant
right.
to the picture.
Right. Right.
And eventually, it's interesting, we're going to see, I believe, how, and excuse me if you're offended, if I'm offending millions of people around the world,
uh-huh.
but we're going to see how Islam will completely lose its relevance as a domination-seeking religion,
mm-hmm.
and it will be sort of, I would say, diluted and becoming part of a new world movement, of a new world religion.
Yeah.
You know, they will be humbled on the mountains of Israel, as Ezekiel
right,
said.
Right, right.
And once that attempt, you see, the first tier of countries coming against Israel, it wasn't really religious. It was mostly political. They, obviously with some religious roots, but they didn't want to see that the newborn state of Israel, it was an offense.
You're referring to Psalm 83.
I'm talking about Psalm 83, but I'm talking about 1948, 1956, 1967, 73. All those wars basically exhausted all the countries around us to the point that two of the major ones are already having peace with Israel.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's going to take much more for the mother of Shiite Islam, Iran, and also other countries around the mother of Sunni Islam to be. I mean, you see, Erdogan wants to be once again the leader of the caliphate of the Sunni world. And that's what the Ottoman Empire used to be. He wants to restore the Ottoman Empire to the point where he is the leader. He is the one who leads the effort to bring about a Sunni domination. So when you see those two countries humbled,
mm-hmm.
defeated, bleeding, and it's going to be so hard. You see, the first tier of countries already tasted the taste of defeat.
Mm-hmm.
And they learned their lesson. The second tier has not done so. And once they learn that, it will bring about such a disappointment, religious disappointment, to the point that you're going to see millions upon millions of Muslims seeking a new direction, a new religion, a new faith, a new, just as good people. You know, we don't want to get in trouble with anyone anymore.
Anymore. Yeah.
Exactly. And you see that even now.
How do you, from your perspective, see Zechariah 12 concerning Jerusalem being a burdensome stone and a cup of trembling, an intoxicating cup. And how do you see that in concert with and relation with, say, the prophecy in Ezekiel 38?
Well, I personally look at both Zechariah 12, 13, and 14 as a description of the last war, which is the war that we all call Armageddon. Exactly. And we know that it's going to be Jerusalem for two reasons. Jerusalem will be, A, it's going to be Jerusalem because the Jews are kicked out of it. Mm-hmm. B, it's going to be Jerusalem because the Antichrist will rule from it also. Mm-hmm. And I can see how the world will, in it, Jerusalem will be a city that will become such a poisonous source that anyone who will touch it will. But we must understand something, that sometimes we see a prophecy, but it's not coming to pass overnight. The entire conflict over Jerusalem is something that exists already. It's something that we see built up already. Mm-hmm. It's something that we see, and remember, it is in Zechariah 12, if I'm not mistaken, and they see the one whom they pierced. Yes. I have to relate Zechariah 12 with that war that eventually Jesus comes back.
And they behold.
Exactly. So Zechariah 12, you see that. In Zechariah 14, you see that his feet are standing on Mount of Olives.
Right.
To me, that's why I take 12, 13, talking about two-thirds of Israel perishing.
Right.
In the last third, he will lead through the fire. I look at all three chapters as more of a description of the last war. So, in my eyes, Ezekiel 30 and 39 will be before the rise of the Antichrist. And the Zechariah portion of war will be after. That's how I take it.
Right. Talk a little bit about Isaiah 17 with relation to
what's going on?
Damascus and Syria. And if you can, maybe weave into the fabric of the Isaiah 17 prophecy concerning Syria, how you see the Islamic State now sort of playing into the broader scheme of things.
Yeah. First of all, I've always said about ISIS that God is allowing us through ISIS to see what the world looked like before Israel entered the land and what the world is going to look like when the Antichrist is going to rule the land. Which means, before Israel entered the land, if you remember carefully, before Israel entered the land, the Gentile nations that lived in the land of Israel, they had horrible practices. Mm-hmm. And one of them was beheading. Another one would be sacrificing human sacrifices, cutting limbs. And of course, I'm not even mentioning the sexual abuse of girls and all that. That was not a crime in the life of the Canaanites of the land of Israel. That was a habit.
Right.
That was a lifestyle, not a crime. Right. When Israel was led into the land, God said, go and leave no one alive, because obviously that innocent blood cried out before the Lord. So you see a glimpse with ISIS of what the world looked like then, but then you also look at what the world is going to look like when they will kick God out and the Antichrist is going to rule.
Yeah.
The Bible talks about the beheaded saints.
Yes.
Now, everybody is holding a beheading right now as a crime,
right.
Don't we?
Right.
That's going to be the practice of the Antichrist,
right.
Not a crime.
For those who refuse the mark.
And who is going to be around the Antichrist? All those peace-loving people.
Right, right.
All those who think that we are bigots, that we are trying to start a war. All those who think that we're radicals, that we are extremists.
Yeah.
When we're gone, they will have a sigh of relief that we're gone. And all these peaceniks, we call them, all these peace-loving, all those tree-hugging people, all those people will embrace a person who will actually regulate beheading as a practice. Can
right.
you imagine?
Right.
So ISIS is there now. ISIS is stirring up the pot right now. I don't see ISIS in the Bible prophecy when it comes to Ezekiel,
okay.
But it's definitely causing things to happen in the Middle East for the Ezekiel prophecy.
A prelude of
sorts. Exactly.
Right.
It is because of ISIS that apparently Russia invaded into Syria. It's because of ISIS that Syria has a problem right now. with the entire West. I don't know if you know that as of this morning, there's a big news article about the Incirlik, the airbase that they have that was built by the U.S. Navy in 1951 in Turkey.
Turkey, right.
And that Incirlik airbase has dozens of nuclear warheads.
Right.
I don't know. And I don't know if you know that, but Erdogan is now basically besieging that airbase, not allowing anyone
U.S. military
U.S. military personnel.
Yeah.
They're not. He cut the electricity. He cut the water. Yeah. You're talking about an international crisis that is not being talked about, but it is on the ground, and there are nuclear warheads on location right there, right now. So we are looking at, and that, by the way, that is the reason why all air activity against ISIS is suspended, because this is the airbase from which the U.S. Military would...
You're hearing this in Israel. We are not hearing it in the United States.
Well, because what you're hearing in the United States, obviously, is... all your elections baloney. I mean, I'm sorry, but it's
so
crazy.
Apologize.
I mean, I'm
that's
turning
you're
on,
kindly.
I'm turning on TV and
it's all
I
Trump,
cannot
Clinton, Trump,
imagine
Clinton.
The amount of garbage on TV.
Yeah.
And this is a major, major news piece that people are ignoring right now. So ISIS is there, I believe, to stir up the pot, to somehow ignite or push some sort of things to happen, but they will not play a bigger and a more significant role later. One other role I think ISIS is going to do is create in Europe antagonism towards Islam and create amongst the Muslims the desire to seek a different direction and to be all do good, be good, and say good, and be part of the new movement that the Catholic Church is spearheading.
Right. So you have the Pope and Roman Catholicism sort of as the head,
correct,
as it were,
spearheading
and,
that effort.
Right. Do you see then? The Pope, Roman Catholicism today, this Pope particularly, being a catalyst, for lack of a better word, that brings together not just Sunni and Shia Islam, but also all of the major world religions, including Islam and Catholicism and Judaism and all of the above.
I will tell you even more.
Okay.
The agenda of the Catholic Church today is far beyond the religious realm.
Uh-huh.
So yes, they do have the interdenominational and the ecumenical movement to speak to other religions, but it's far beyond that. The Pope is now into getting all the scientists, academic institution also into, by saying that he doesn't believe, by the way, that God has miraculously, magically created everything like that with a magic stick. He believed that things had to evolve. By doing so, he says, I believe in the evolution.
Evolutionary
creation.
Correct.
He doesn't, he actually says that the Big Bang Theory and the story of the creation can be reconciled. They can live together. So to say that it's only about religion, no, he's going to be way beyond that.
Hmm.
He's going to talk to other religions. He's going to talk to other movements, sexual movements, scientific movements. Everything is now being on the radar of the Catholic Church to reconcile and to bring. But the first thing they do, before we reach out to other religions, let's reach out to the different denominations within the Church. And I've seen unbelievable video footage of the Pope personally addressing conferences of evangelical Christians trying to tell them that we are all Catholics because Catholicism means universal, and that diversion is diabolic and unity is important, and all of that. Yes, JD, it is reaching out to Sunni and to Shiite Muslims, but it's also reaching out to the Far Eastern religions, and it's also reaching out to Judaism as well as the inside of the Christianity, but way beyond that.
Right.
It's scary to see if you're not ready.
Yeah.
It's scary to see how much they go for that. I mean, there are yoga classes in cathedrals. You have inside, I've seen footage of a grand cathedral in San Francisco where in the entire hall of the church they have yoga classes. And that's how far we have things done right now in order to include everybody. It's all inclusive. And you know, be good, feel good, say good things, and all going to be okay. And you know, in one of the speeches of the Pope a couple of years ago, he said, even the atheists are going to be saved. They're all redeemed because, you know, the blood of Christ redeemed us all. You know, you can be an atheist. I mean, even John Paul II, in the year 2000, one of his messages in December of 2000 said that all who live in accordance of the Bible Beatitudes, even if they do not belong to the church or believe in Jesus Christ, will enter the kingdom. As long as you're humble, as long as you're okay, as long as you do good, feel good, be a good person.
Be a good person.
So you can imagine when there's only 5% of the Muslims that are violent and 95% of them aren't, and they see how Islam is losing ground, how many of them are now going to get this invitation of, you want to be part of the do good, be good, see good, and you don't want to be tagged as Muslims, as radicals, why don't you join us? You're still going to be Muslims because the name of your religion is irrelevant.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to, you know, crucify yourself or do that. You don't have to eat certain food or avoid other things. You can just stay who you are as long as you're a good person.
Good person.
That's all that matters.
And really, isn't not this Pope already furthering that?
This Pope did more than any other Pope in history.
In just a short period of time.
Correct. Yeah. It's almost scary to see that. Hmm. You know, I talked to you about what he said that, you know, what he's trying to achieve. But I don't know if you remember, but in January of 2016, there was a horrible terrorist attack in Paris that people kind of forgot.
Sure.
And that was in the Charlie Hebdo newspaper editorial.
Yep.
And all the staff members of that magazine were murdered, they were executed. And when the Pope was asked about it, he was on a flight on the plane. When he was asked about it, you know what he said? If somebody calls my mom a name, I will smack him too. Basically saying, I understand why these terrorists...
He legitimized it.
Exactly.
He legitimized it.
So you see that the effort goes way beyond religion. It goes to even get the terrorists to somehow sympathize with him.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
What is the spiritual temperature in Israel today concerning peace, the two-state solution, and the potential for the subsequent rebuilding of their temple?
I believe that the last 10 years were the sobering up period for most Israelis to understand that peace in our time is probably not going to happen.
Hmm.
They understand that there is really nothing to talk about and no one to talk to. And why? Why is that so?
Hmm.
I just sent my son to the army a week ago. The last thing I want is a war.
Right.
The first thing I want is peace.
Right.
Especially now. It's not me walking or going and holding it. It's my son.
Yeah.
We all have a special feeling for that. And however, we still see the Palestinian authorities teaching their children that there is no such thing as Israel. they obviously hail and sanctify every terrorist as a martyr. And you see that in school camps, they are teaching them how to shoot and how to kill and how to murder. You can see that on the other side, there is really no one to talk to and really nothing to talk about. Because as long as Israel will exist and Jerusalem is our capital, they won't accept us. I'm sorry. They won't accept us. And to be honest with you, JD, I look at all my Bible from Genesis to Revelation, and I couldn't find a Palestinian state there. I tried. But I did find countries like Jordan, countries like Syria, countries like Egypt, countries like Lebanon. I found all those sovereign countries either in a relation to a war or peace, but I found them there. I couldn't find that which everybody calls Palestine. So I'm not worried that Israel will be taken by the Palestinians and become Palestine. I'm not even worried that somebody will try to impose a peace process, because at this point, all we need to worry about is what you started your question with, Isaiah 17.
17, yeah.
I'm a major in Israel. I come from a military background, and the eyes of the Israeli military right now are not fixed on anything else but on Damascus. At this current point.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know that one of the things I always tell people is that I have colleagues, counterparts on the Jordanian side that I used to talk to when I was, you know, deputy governor of Jericho, and later on the peace process began, and we turned Jericho into Palestinian Authority's first city in the West Bank.
And that's when you met Yasser Arafat. Correct. And
correct.
Abu Mazen,
you know, I brought him in.
My people.
Yes. But the thing is that what I want to share with you is that the doctrine of the Jordanian army is Israel is not our problem. We need to put our back towards Israel and our face towards the east, because that's where the problems are coming from.
Yeah.
They're not even worried about us. Mm-hmm. In fact, Israel is not. So Jordan is not the problem. Assisi is fighting terrorism. No other. He just killed the leader of ISIS in Sinai yesterday. Mm-hmm. And ISIS is furious right now.
Right.
So Egypt is on our side. Jordan is on our side. The Lebanese, even Hezbollah, understands what they did to us in 2006 caused them so much damage,
right,
that they are going to think 50,000 times before they start again.
Right.
So I don't see a problem there. The biggest problem we're going to have is Damascus right now. And the reason is very simple. Damascus is the merging point of interest of West, South, East, and North. You can see that Russia has its interest in there. Iran wants Syria to remain Shiite control. Saudi wants to have a buffer of Sunni area. You see Turkey is bordering with Syria. It wants to call the shots there because anything that happens in Syria will affect Turkey. You can clearly see that behind the scene, Syria is actually endeared by everyone around. So whatever happens to Damascus will immediately ignite something. Now, the question is, Isaiah 17 says that Damascus will cease from being a city.
It never happened. Uninhabitable. Right.
Exactly. It never happened.
Right.
I mean, I'm looking at my Bible, and I see that Damascus was a vibrant city in the time of Jesus, and that Paul was on the way to Damascus. You see that it was there. Never in the history of planet Earth, Damascus, since the moment it was built, was uninhabitable. Never. So obviously, when Isaiah says, I am God, there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things that are not yet done, Isaiah 17 falls on the not yet done.
Right.
And he speaks of a future event where Damascus will be destroyed. Now the question is, who will destroy Damascus?
Right.
That doesn't say that.
We're not told.
We're not told. But you and I know that no matter what's going to happen, Israel will be blamed for it.
Right.
So whether the rebels, ISIS,
yeah,
Russia,
yeah,
whoever is going to put that match and to light that fire, Israel will be held, as a responsible for it, because they think that we are having the most to gain from that thing. So whether Israel will attack or whether someone else will attack, Israel will pay the price for Damascus being destroyed. And this is exactly what I believe, that which will ignite eventually Ezekiel 38 and 39.
So you see Isaiah 17 being the
catalyst.
The catalyst.
Being
the trigger. The trigger.
Exactly, the
yeah,
trigger. That, I've always said that.
Yeah.
Because if you really think about it, why would Russia come against Israel at this point unless Russia is involved in Syria?
Mm-hmm.
Why would Iran do that? Why would Turkey do that? The thing that unites all those three is the fact that Syria is in flames right now.
Right.
And
it's so strategic as a nexus.
Exactly.
But I wanted to talk a little bit about the recent find there in the Mediterranean Sea of natural gas and potentially oil, and how that is really a game changer now,
yeah,
especially as it relates to Russia.
Yes. You see, the Russians aren't really into politics.
Mm-hmm.
Let's face it. They could care less if the Palestinians get Palestine or the Jordanians get Jordan, or they could care less about the fights that thousands of years of old battle between religions and faiths and people. All they care about, and they say that, is gas and oil. Russia wants to preserve its status as the number one country in the world that exports natural gas. Russia's economy is horrible. The only thing that they can maybe hang on to is their gas domination. And they want to make sure that not only they control all the gas in the region, but also the way to bring the gas to places and control the prices as well. And Russia for years had a front arm in the in Syria in ways of the naval port of Tarsus, the naval base in the port of Tarsus. Now, lately, Russia started showing interest in the newly Israeli found gas. They even Vladimir Putin came with, you know, the huge Antonov airplane loaded with people. We thought they're all going to be experts on security. We thought it's going to be the Ministry of Defense talking about Syria and the civil war. No, but all he brought is people in from the gas and the oil industry.
That's when he met with Netanyahu.
Correct. When he came to Israel and he inaugurated some sort of a monument in the city of Netanya and all that. And so we were quite amazed because he literally came to put on the table an offer that Israel will give him a stake in our gas finding. Uh-huh. Netanyahu did not really collaborate with that. But, you know, if there's one thing you can say about Vladimir Putin is that he has some patience. He can wait. And he waited. And now, seeing the rift between the Israelis and the American administration, he's with an open arm, welcoming Netanyahu every time Netanyahu comes to Moscow. And it's only a matter of time before he will re-propose to have a stake in the Israeli gas and oil. Now, I believe that the hook in the jaw is the gas and the oil. The hook, I mean, that's the only thing that brings them down to this area. Not even now, even before. Their arm in the port of Tarsus was always because of their interest in the gas and oil. Now, by the way, not only Israel has gas. Egypt found gas, Cyprus found gas. The region has gas, and they want to dominate that gas. And we can see that happening. Now, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we would all be sitting here perplexed at what would be the hook in the jaw of Rosh and Meshik and Tuval to bring them to our region.
Right.
We don't need to anymore.
Yeah.
Now we see it happening.
Mm-hmm.
It is quite amazing.
Yeah. So what is the relationship now between Putin and Netanyahu, given that our president, Barack Hussein Obama, has in effect deputized Russia and Iran. He has handed
Correct.
The Middle East
Exactly.
to Russia and Iran.
He did that in
single-handedly.
Yes. He did that with the red line that he crossed 50,000 times during the crisis with Syria.
Yeah.
And ever since, he did that also with the Iran deal and other things.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But Netanyahu knows who Putin really is,
correct.
Right?
Netanyahu knows who Putin really is because Israel is drenched with Russians.
Hmm.
We have Russian politicians in the Israeli parliament who
right.
speaks Russian. We understand the culture. We understand the language.
Mm-hmm.
Our minister of defense is a Viktor Lieberman, born in Russia, raised
right,
in Russia,
right,
speaking
right.
fluent Russian. So we understand who we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
At this current position right now, when Russia is physically present right around us, next to our border, it makes sense for us to go to Moscow and collaborate and coordinate with them. What would any trip to Washington do to prevent the Russians from attacking our aircraft when we destroy weapons shipment right above the skies of Syria?
Right.
We need actually a mechanism between us and the Russians to collaborate on that issue. So Israel understands that at the present time, it's not going to be forever, there is a great value for us in collaboration with the Russians. However, we also understood that that may not hold water for too long, and that explains the Israeli new offense to get support in the African continent as well. Israel has never ever been so aggressively seeking for international acceptance as it is right now. Prime Minister Netanyahu is probably apart from obviously Washington and Moscow, is the most visited head of state in the world.
Interesting.
We have, if you go on our prime minister's Facebook account,
right,
and you can see every single day we have some head of state coming to visit. There's no such thing in the world.
Right.
So you can understand that we are in a very interesting time period right now.
Yeah.
And the separation between us and the American administration, which used to be under the ground, has surfaced lately to the point the Americans unofficially told us that they will not anymore automatically veto anything against Israel in the UN.
I know, right.
We have to live with that reality right now.
Yeah.
Now, I could have told you that 15 years ago. Why? Because I'm not really fed by the media. I call them the media nights.
Right.
I'm not fed by the media. I'm fed by what the Bible told me that is going to happen.
Uh-huh.
And I'm actually smiling when I see how current events fit into Bible prophecy,
right,
and not the opposite. We don't have to rewrite the Bible. They
right.
have to obviously get their act together. And that's why I love to see how in Psalm 2, God is smiling at all of those, you know.
He laughs at them because he knows their end.
Exactly.
Right.
They don't have a clue
right.
that they do that which he, at least allowing them to do,
right.
and it plays perfectly into his plan.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why, you know, I'm thinking often about on Herod or Pontius Pilate, for example. Pontius Pilate, really, in his wildest dreams, did not have a clue that he will be in the books of history and he will be such an important figure. Pontius Pilate actually wanted to run away or get rid of the Jewish people in the first visit of him to the land. Little did he know that the events of his first week in the land of Israel would prepare his heart for later on condemning Jesus.
Huh.
Years later in Jerusalem on Passover. When you come to Israel and we go to Caesarea,
right.
I'm going to share that with you.
Oh,
because,
that.
By the way, it's written in Josephus' book,
that's right.
The Jewish War.
That's right.
It's all written by
yeah.
So you can see how world leaders, whether it's today or 2,000 years ago, they make their decisions based on fear or based on political climate, but they have no clue how God is going to use it for his own purposes
right.
and his own plan. And the fact that he encountered some Jewish rebellion on the week that he has arrived caused him not to want to get into trouble with them years later and to condemn Jesus to death. Because in any other circumstance, he wouldn't really care about what the masses are saying.
Right.
And if he thought that Jesus is innocent, he would have released him, but not then and not there.
You know, it's interesting, my prophecy update last Sunday, I talked a little bit about our presidential
election
this year. And it was really to be a word of encouragement, to us here in America. Believe me, Amir, if God did not call me to suffer for the Lord in paradise on earth, I would love to, like Joel Rosenberg, whom you know, personally, move to, Israel. I'm going somewhere with this, but I made this comment about how that God raises up kings and he takes down kings.
Right.
And he appoints rulers. And he only does it to serve his end.
Exactly.
His purpose for his glory and our good. Even though they are evil rulers, God works it for good. I think about Joseph, my favorite, hero, man of God in the Bible.
Exactly.
When he finally reveals his identity to his brothers in Genesis 50:20. I mean, it is just so powerful.
That was the enemy
meant for evil.
God turned it into
to save many people this day.
Amen.
This day.
Yes.
And I just think to myself that, you know, what God is doing, he's orchestrating. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting you bring up Pontius Pilate, because God, it says in Proverbs, he directs them the way a river is directed downstream.
And they don't know that.
And they don't know.
And they actually, if you ask most of them,
right,
don't agree with the Bible, don't agree with the Word of God. They
right.
could care less about the Word of God. Their agenda is what consumes their minds and their actions.
Right.
Yet they don't have a clue.
You know, I just remember we have a few more minutes here. When you were with Jack Hibbs in California, and you were talking about how that the likes of a President Richard Nixon,
yes,
when he was a young boy, and his mother, perhaps you could share that story. It's just amazing.
Well, you know, 1973 was about to be a war that Israel will be completely annihilated. In fact, Moshe Dayan, the hero of 1967, the Ministry of Defense, told Golda Meir, the prime minister at the time of the Yom Kippur War, Golda, we're about to lose the third temple, which means, Golda, Israel is going to go down the drains. It's the end of this story of the Jewish people in the Middle East. That was the feel. And Golda Meir picked up the phone and called the White House at 3 a.m. You don't do that to a sitting president unless something. And she said, Mr. President, if within the next 24 to 48 hours, America is not going to help us. We will not exist anymore. And President Nixon, it's 3 a.m., you wake up in the middle of the night, you pause, and then he says, you know what, Golda? When I was a young boy, my mother used to read me every night Bible stories. And I remember there was one time she read me a Bible story, and she stopped and she said, Richard, I want you to promise me that if you will get to a position in the future where you can help save the Jewish people, you must do so. And he said to Golda, maybe now for the first time I understand why I became president of the United States of America. He hung up the phone, he called the Pentagon, and within the next 48 hours, the largest shipment of armaments since World War II was on its way to the Middle East. And that changed the shift and caused Israel to go from the defense to the offense. And eventually the war ended up with the enemy not even winning a single square inch.
Huh.
Yes, we lost many soldiers. Yes, it was a surprise war. Yes, they took us by surprise and we were not prepared. And we had a very bad and wrong concept that they are not going to start a war. But eventually a Bible storytelling mother changed the whole thing. And that, of course, stands in complete opposite to a sitting president right now, which I'm not sure how the Bible plays a role in his decision-making right now. But to all those Bible storytelling mothers today, I'm just saying,
yes,
don't stop doing that,
yes,
because you could just never know.
Yeah.
And, you know, who's in your house and what he's going to be in the future.
I think of Esther, and Mordechai says to her, you know, how do you know that God did not raise you up and position you for such a time as this? And I love
yes,
hearing that. I've shared in the past how that, and for me as an Arab, so-called Palestinian, that's what I was told growing up, is that I'm Palestinian and that your people, the Jewish people. By the way, I want you to know Amir speaks better Arabic than I do. your people took our land. And then I come to Christ at age 19 and I knew the truth. So.
And the truth set you free.
It set me free. And whom the Son has set free is free indeed. But, I just remember how that growing up, you know, as you looked at Israel and you saw how God over the years had protected Israel, his people. And one of the things that I've really dealt with, and we had talked about this because I have a huge Arab family here in America, many of whom were sponsored into the United States by my parents when we moved to America when I was 9 months old. And it's been extremely difficult, for the exception of a few of my cousins who came to Christ, you know, thank the Lord that they did when they did. But other than them, it has been so difficult to communicate to them that as a born-again Christian Arab, I know in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek nor Gentile nor Arab, but as a Christian Arab, that God has a covenant with Israel, and God, it is an everlasting covenant, And if God is through with the Jew, the way we were told and taught growing up, then how secure are you? You alluded to it on Thursday night, that if God has a covenant with Israel and God is through with the Jew, then what's to say that God's not going to be through with me and you too?
Exactly. You know, the personal advisor of Queen Victoria in England, Sir Walter Raleigh, was asked by the Queen one day, give me a proof that there is a God. And he says, I will give you proof, Israel. And she was perplexed. And he said, if Israel is still there, then there must be a God. God's, I would call it insurance policy, is Israel's existence.
Yeah.
Now, the problem that I have with a lot of people around the world is either they deny the role of Israel or they idolize Israel. These are two problems.
Extreme.
Exactly. And we have to take things in the right proportion. But I must say that it's such an honor to me to be here with you, because I think this picture of a Jew and a Gentile, of an Arab and a Jew here, like-minded because of Christ, I think it's the biggest testimony you can get to what Christ can do in the life of a person, and to the fact that the truth indeed sets people free.
Right.
And the fact that brotherhood is not based on anything but our unity in Christ. And I would have never imagined in my wildest dreams that I will have to fly all the way to Hawaii to sit with my Arab brother and do some sort of a live interview for thousands of people worldwide. But God is so amazing.
But God and only God
could
do this.
Exactly.